The Guardian.
Trouble at the civil service, the US Democrats prepare for Super Tuesday, and the EU clashes with Britain ahead of trade talks. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
A Chancellor, like all Cabinet Ministers, has to be able to give candid advice to a Prime Minister so he is speaking truth to power. I believe that the arrangement proposed would significantly inhibit that. Now, I don't intend to dwell further on all the details and the personalities. The comings and goings, if you will.
With reports of bullying, sackings and briefings against civil servants emerging from Whitehall, is Number 10 at war with its officials? And also, as Bernie Sanders stormed to victory in Nevada, a new poll gave President Trump his highest ratings yet. Could a Sanders victory in the Democratic primaries spell another 4 years of Trump? And as the EU and UK Brexit trade deal negotiators get ready for talks to begin next week, is chlorinated chicken on or off the menu? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, after Priti Patel's attempt last week to oust her most senior civil servant, Sir Philip Ruttenham, and the swift departure of political forecaster and eugenics fan, Andrew Savisky, it appears that all is not well in Whitehall. Since Johnson became Prime Minister in August, his administration has been accused of bullying civil service staff. And following reports earlier this month that some special advisers had sought counselling for stress, Dominic Cummings said they should toughen up. And now, following threats by Cummings to radically shake up Whitehall, there are reports that the Prime Minister is targeting three permanent secretaries who have made the mistake of offering advice that the government didn't like the sound of. To discuss this and more, I'm joined in the studio by political journalist Marie Leconte, former special advisor to Theresa May, Raoul Ruparel, and Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London and Deputy Director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe. So, Raoul, let's start with you because you've worked in government fairly recently. Does all this sort of stuff sound fairly familiar to you? Is it just a kind of the typical Whitehall shenanigans that happen when you've got a new Prime Minister taking over?
Well, I think you always have clashes behind the scenes between civil servants and government ministers and advisers. It's natural that they're going to have different views on things, and that's part of the way that policy gets made. And so I don't think it's that unusual. I do think it's obviously gone to another level, though, with the briefing that's coming out from both sides. And I don't think that's particularly helpful or healthy. And so it needs to be some way needs to be found to resolve it. I think in the end, both sides have to remember that they need each other. They have to work together to get this done and to make progress in their policy agenda. You know, as much as the political level might like to do it, they can't do it without the civil service. And as much as the civil service might think they can take the decisions, ultimately they can't, and they need the political direction. So they need to find a better way of working together. But I don't think having clashes is unusual. It just needs to be brought back to a more normal level in a more constructive way.
And Marie, Dominic Cummings, who's the Prime Minister's de facto chief of staff, a lot of all this is getting blamed on him. Do you think that's fair, tracing it back to his very tough attitude towards the civil service?
I mean, I do think so. And I think that what's quite interesting about Dominic Cummings is that he is first and foremost a campaigner, and so seems to be looking at everything through the lens of do voters care? Because actually, you know, that's kind of how they won, I think, 2019, and it's a bet that they made and, you know, and won. But the problem is, I'm not really sure that's how you can govern, really, of looking at everything, saying, okay, well, you know, do voters care about this? If so, we probably need to, you know, go softer or do something else. If voters don't care, we can do whatever we want. That's not really, I think, conducive to kind of, you know, good government and good policymaking. So I do think a lot of it does come from him, but also clearly from the fact that people below him, I think, do not necessarily feel comfortable going against him.
And Tim, do you think, it's a very good point that Marie made, do you think voters do actually care about special advisers and the Westminster bubble, or is this all just going totally over everybody's head?
I think, to be honest, most voters probably wouldn't even know what a special adviser was, let alone was a SPAD.
Do you think they've heard of Dominic Cummings, though?
I'm sure they've heard of Dominic Cummings. I mean, I think, you know, what we've discussed so far is absolutely right, really. I mean, this has gone on for a very long time. If you go back to the diaries of Richard Crossman, who was a cabinet minister in the 1960s, he's discussing there how to get rid of his permanent secretary because he can't get anything done with her and doesn't get on with her. So it's pretty familiar, this. I mean, I think, though, as Marie says, Dominic Cummings does perhaps bring an extra dimension and an extra edge to this, in the sense that he is and sees himself as one of life's disruptors, as it were. So there's an extent to which he almost has to see what, when he was at education, called the blob, as something to be overcome. And the civil service, as far as he sees it, I suspect, is part of that blob.
Raoul, from your experience of the civil service, how effective do you think they might be at fighting back against any attempt to clip their wings?
Well, look, in my experience, the civil service can at times go slow and not always deliver in a way that you might want it to if it doesn't necessarily agree with the direction. But I think for the most part, in my experience, when they're given clear political direction, the civil service responds quite well. And most, I think during my time in government under Theresa May, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of lack of clarity. And I think the civil service really struggled with that. And so I think actually there is some relief at having at least some clarity and direction. But of course, I think if you go entirely to war with the machine, it can cause problems. And so I think it needs to be done in the right way. And I think, you know, finding a constructive way to work together, ultimately politicians are there to give direction, civil service to implement it. I think that's known. I think just getting back onto that even keel is necessary.
Yeah, I think the other thing that civil servants like, though, is a minister who can get his or her way in cabinet. And I think one thing they will worry about is if they feel that their minister and indeed other ministers are being overridden, if you like, by a non-elected politician, if you can call them that.
And Marie, it does seem very much like Number 10 is trying to centralise things. We saw this with the effective forcing out of the Chancellor, Sajid Javid, and Number 10 trying to bring Treasury special advisers under their own wing. Do you think that'll be a successful strategy? How much can Number 10 control across the whole of government?
I'm sure the government can try to do that. But also, I find it quite striking that I think, to different extents, of course, but every government, I think every new government that comes in, every new prime minister will end up kind of trying to centralise things to an extent. I think, you know, Theresa May did as well. And before that, David Cameron, etc. So, you know, it's kind of nearly a tradition, I think, for a new prime minister to come in and say, actually, you know, Number 10 needs more power if you need to be across everything. And I think that there's a reason why that effort needs to be made again and again each time there's a new prime minister, because I think each PM finds out eventually that that's not how it works. And actually, you know, Number 10 cannot do everything itself. And that's why there are so many departments and a cabinet.
And we're coming up to the budget, Raoul. The Treasury has traditionally been a bit of a bulwark against perhaps some of the excesses of Number 10. Number 10 wants to spend, and the Treasury or other departments want to, and the Treasury says no. We've got this new Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, that nobody knows that much about. Do you think he'll be effective at standing up to Number 10?
Well, I think he has to decide exactly where he wants to fit in that. And obviously, he'll be considering exactly what approach to take in the budget now. But yeah, there has, you're right, been a traditional dividing line. And I think one of the upshots of having this combined unit could be that we see a bit less focus on the fiscal framework and on the fiscal rules and a bit more emphasis on the outcomes of the economic policy and the desire to spend. So we could see a bit of a bit looser fiscal policy in the budget and a bit more of a giveaway budget than we were maybe expecting before. But in the end, you know, the Treasury is there to keep a handle on these things. And, you know, we do have an ageing population. We do have, you know, quite a high debt level, potentially a growing deficit. And so it's something that needs to be kept under review and kept to be sustainable. And that's the main thing that the Treasury is there to do, to keep an eye on this and make sure it can balance out the demands of all the other departments. So they need to not lose sight of that. But equally, I do think we will see a bit of a change from this new setup.
And Tim, all these Whitehall briefing wars, special advisers saying one thing and people close to senior civil servants saying another, and Dominic Cummings wanting to radically reshape the whole of the civil service. Do you think that with all this sort of turmoil, there's a risk of the government taking its eye off the key goals, which is that, you know, effectively Boris Johnson said he wanted to level up across the country and he wanted to get Brexit and EU trade talks done?
Well, in some ways, the two are connected, aren't they? Because I feel Dominic Cummings and indeed Boris Johnson feel that they can't do what they want to do unless they do have this kind of reorganisation, which is, you know, causing the turmoil in the first place. I mean, back to the budget. I mean, I think the Conservatives have got a problem in the sense that they ruled out all sorts of ways of increasing revenue in their manifesto, and they're going to have to look for other ways of doing it. Now, one thing they have tried to suggest is that they're going to spend money, you know, on infrastructure, so it'll be capital rather than current spending. But if you look at the problems in the health service, for example, that we've heard about very recently, there's no way that capital spending is actually going to solve that. You know, there's no point building more hospitals in 5 years' time. People are waiting on trolleys now, and we have the coronavirus possibly, you know, posing a major threat. So there is going to have to be some leeway, I think, on borrowing if he's not going to increase taxation.
And do you think, Marie, that some of these fiscal rules that Sajid Javid laid down at the election only a couple of months ago could be just thrown out the window?
I do think we may see that, but I wonder actually, sort of like coming back to what Tim was mentioning as well, that it does feel to me so far like a government who keeps trying to say that, you know, their ideas are so big and so ambitious that actually they can't really do any of it. And so actually looking at, again, you know, all the constraints of the budget, for example, or the problems of Whitehall, etc., it kind of feels like it's a government that's making excuses for itself to an extent, you know, of saying, oh, yeah, no, but, you know, all these wonderful sort of like huge things we want to do, but actually, you know, afraid we can't because of X and Y and Z. And maybe, you know, it may well be the case that the budget is kind of the start of the new era of the Boris government of saying, you know, we're going to do these massive things. So again, looking at big infrastructure projects being an example. But I do worry that it may stay on again, being that, oh, well, actually, no, but soon we'll do all these massive things, but then nothing actually happens. There's a lot of over-briefing, I think, and under-delivering going on at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've got used to the idea recently, particularly perhaps in the media and some academics, that, you know, politics and elections are all about values. But actually, you know, what political scientists call valence, in other words, competence and delivery, still does matter a lot to voters. And, you know, if it you know, comes to be seen as a government that can't manage things, that can't actually get things done, that can't keep the promises it made, it is going to be in trouble. Whether or not it wants to wage some kind of culture war, that's not as important to most voters as actually, you know, what comes to them over the next 4 years.
And Raoul, do you think that the prominence of Dominic Cummings and him sort of being used as a lightning rod, in effect, for the Prime Minister is going to become a problem for Boris Johnson anytime soon? Because at the moment, he seems to be such a prominent figure in the newspapers, whereas Boris Johnson has been off on holiday in Mystique, and then he sort of disappeared over the half-term break for 12 days and nobody saw him during the floods. Do you think this relationship between the two of them is working out?
Well, I think, look, if you look at the reshuffle, in the end it went in the direction Dominic Cummings would have wanted it to, I think. And so there were lots of questions ahead whether he would win and whether it would go that way. And the evidence suggests it has. So I think people are a bit potentially overplaying that this might blow up and that there's a split between him and the PM. You know, from what I can see, actually, the PM trusts him and you know, listens to his advice. You know, there are some similarities, obviously, between the Nick and Fiona Hill relationship with Theresa May, and obviously that eventually came crashing down, but it was a poor election result that triggered that. And the question here is, what will trigger? You know, there's a lot of talk of Dominic Cummings will eventually burn out or self-destruct, and you know, he won't be there for the long term. But you know, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. You know, what is going to trigger that? From what I can see, and you know, he has a pretty good relationship with the PM, and you know, there is a sense that this is working. He helped orchestrate the election victory, and they're getting, as they see it, getting stuff done. You know, whether it will actually get done, as Marie was saying, we'll see. But yeah, so I'm not sure that it will all come crashing down, which seems to be the assumption of some people.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, we'll be talking to Karen Robinson from the Primarily 2020 podcast about the Democratic primaries, and we'll also be looking ahead to the beginning of the Brexit trade talks next week. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, could we be looking at a second term for President Donald Trump? His popularity rating is improving at a key moment in the election year, boosting his chances of winning a second term in the White House. A new Gallup poll at the weekend gave Trump a 49% approval rating and a disapproval rating of 48%. It was the first net positive for the president in the poll since the beginning of his presidency in January 2017. And with Bernie Sanders now the man to beat in the Democratic primaries, some Democrats are raising concerns about whether Sanders is too divisive a figure to beat Donald Trump in November. Well, I'm joined by Karen Robinson from the Primarily 2020 podcast to discuss. What do you think, Karen? who's going to win the primaries?
Well, without making a declarative statement, I think you're absolutely correct in what you said up front, which is that you have to view Bernie Sanders as the presumptive favorite at this point. He's won all the races so far. We've got another election coming up on Saturday in South Carolina. I expect he probably won't win that, but he might come quite close, which would be bad news for Joe Biden, who was hoping for a very, very clear victory in South Carolina. Having said that, Super Tuesday, which is, you know, just this coming Tuesday, is when a huge number of states will vote. And his support in the states on Super Tuesday is a little bit more mixed. Some other candidates are performing better. And you've got people like, you know, Pete Buttigieg, for example, Elizabeth Warren, who's probably going to do well in a couple of states, in Massachusetts, for example, some others in Virginia. So it's very mixed. And that's, I think, the best news for Sanders is that there are still a lot of other candidates in the race, because it's dividing all the alternative support.
If Sanders doesn't win, who would be the second in position to take over from him, do you think?
Well, so right now, Joe Biden Joe Biden had been the clear front runner in the race from the beginning until people started voting. He was always expected to do not that well in Iowa and New Hampshire, which is what happened. He came in second in Nevada, but not a strong second. So I think he's probably the person who's in second place, but his campaign hasn't really caught fire. He hasn't been great on the stump, and I think that's caused a lot of people to question his viability as a candidate. So that's where some of the concerns has been coming from, and I think that's probably why we do have so many other candidates still in the race.
And the final debate before Super Tuesday was held in Carolina last night, and the other candidates seemed to turn on Sanders somewhat. Is that going to be a good strategy for them, do you think, to gang up on him?
Well, I think it's the only choice they have right now. I mean, it's interesting because until this point, Bernie Sanders has been effectively the front runner for a little while now, but he hasn't faced the front runner type scrutiny in a debate. So last night is the first time that we saw people actually confronting him as a front runner and taking him on head to head. And I think it's good that we do that, only because every candidate should have, you know, serious scrutiny, especially somebody who's the presumptive nominee. We need to see what kind of attacks are going to be leveled on them and how they'll respond to them. So last night's the first night we did that. I feel like it may be a little too late, in the sense of there's a momentum building. Bernie's done a great job of building an organization. He's effectively been campaigning continuously since 2016. So he's far ahead in terms of his ground organization in a lot of places. I wonder whether kind of a late attempt to take him down in a debate is going to be enough, because we also need to build up another candidate, and it's unclear right now who that candidate will be.
The demographics of Sanders' victory in Nevada were interesting, because he took 51% of the Latino vote, and he did well with African Americans as well, who traditionally are quite supportive of Biden. How significant do you think that is?
Well, that's a huge development in this primary. You don't win a Democratic nomination without winning support from minority voters, especially African American voters. And in the past, in the 2016 election, Bernie didn't have that much minority support. He's actually been gaining a lot. And I think his Hispanic support has been particularly interesting. He's the only candidate that's demonstrated an ability to gain a lot of Hispanic support so far. And I think a big part of that, if it is true that Sanders takes the nomination, I think you might have to look to the endorsement of House Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as being a hugely consequential impact, because she came out to support him at a moment when Sanders was weakened shortly after he had a heart attack. She came out and supported him. And I think that helped him, first of all, to kind of confirm himself as still a viable candidate, and then to bring over some of those Latino voters.
And what's the significance of Michael Bloomberg in the race, do you think?
He has an enormous amount of money, and he's spending a lot of it. Bloomberg has been a real wild card in this race. Remember, he's only been a Democrat for a very short amount of time. He was a New York mayor as a Republican, and then as an independent, and then as a Democrat. He's spent, I think the last figure I saw, it's probably a lot more now, but something like $346 million in advertising to try and get himself the nomination. And for a while, that seemed to be working very well for him. He was climbing in the polls. In the the penultimate debate, so not this last debate, but the one before that, before Nevada, he was challenged pretty vigorously and pretty effectively, especially by Senator Elizabeth Warren, who really took him down on some of his offensive statements that he's made about women in the past, on the NDAs that he's been holding against women, and just generally on his lack of progressive policies. So I think that we don't know yet what impact that will have on voters, because no one has yet cast a vote for Mike Bloomberg. He's not competing in any of these early states. So he's a real wild card. We don't know what will happen when people start voting for him, which will be on Super Tuesday.
And meanwhile, Trump's approval rating is climbing. A CBS News poll released on Sunday said 65% of voters expect the president to win his re-election bid. So the key question for Democrats is, can Sanders beat Trump?
Well, so I think, first of all, just to kind of add some nuance into that narrative that Trump's approval rating is climbing. It has been climbing in some polls. If you look at the poll of polls, his approval rating has been remarkably flat for his entire presidency. And we haven't seen anything that looks like a significant bump across the piece. And that's really the story of Trump's presidency, is he really struggles to gain anything close to 50% support on a viable basis. So in theory, any one of these candidates can find a path to beat Donald Trump, but they find different paths. So Bernie Sanders, the evidence seems to suggest, and again, it's a dynamic race, things can change, voters' views of the candidates can change. Right now, it seems to look like Bernie is losing a lot of the swing voters that we picked up in the 2018 midterms, but he's gaining a lot of younger voters. Whether that will result in actual turnouts at the polls, that's the anxiety, but that's kind of the game plan that he's been following. The other candidates, at least some of the other candidates, Biden in particular, Buttigieg, seem to do a better job of bringing on board those kind of intermittent Democrats that we won in 2018, and they find that path. Now, that might be an easier electoral path for Democrats because of the Midwestern strategy. So if we gain back those Midwestern states that we lost in 2016, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, then we're done. That's it. We've won the presidency. But those states are on a knife edge, especially Wisconsin, and it could really go either way at this point.
So for Sanders, him losing some swing voters and gaining lots of youth support, a lot of people in the UK will hear that and think Jeremy Corbyn.
It sounds familiar. I'm not going to lie. I see the resonance. Obviously, Sanders is a different candidate. It's a different country. There's a different context to it. But it is true that this is a riskier strategy. It's a scary strategy for a lot of people. It's not to say that Sanders can't do it. It's perfectly possible. But the danger is it causes us to rely on a lot of new voters who may or may not be reliable for us. It also, the concern that a lot of Democrats are raising in Congress is what's the impact on congressional races, because we regained the House in 2018 by winning a lot of those suburban districts that still are on a knife edge. What would Sanders' coattail effect look like? It's a little unclear at this point, but I know a lot of Democrats are nervous about that.
Well, thank you, Karen. And you can hear what happens on Super Tuesday on the Primarily 2020 podcast. Okay, we're going to move on now to chlorinated chicken. Chlorine-washed poultry is fast becoming to the Brexit trade talks what the Irish border was to the Exit Agreement, as Brussels insists that if the UK wants a trade deal, then it has to maintain the ban on it. The EU has consistently refused to weaken its food and farming standards to bring them into line with US ones. But for the Americans, breaking open a major European economy to its agricultural goods is one of the chief prizes of Brexit. So what gives? The trade negotiations kick off on Monday, but what chance of success by the end of the year? Tim, that's the all-important question, isn't it? What chances of success?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the scope and the scale of the trade agreement we're talking about. I mean, Raoul may contradict me, but I cannot imagine a completely comprehensive FTA being done by the end of the year. I can certainly imagine some kind of agreement. You know, some have called it bare bones. Some have called it a kind of fudged transition being agreed by maybe, October, which is probably when it does need to be agreed if it's to get through the various parliamentary hurdles.
And Raoul, do you agree with that? What do you think about whether the UK will in fact have to sign up to common standards with the EU on things like food and farming, which could harm its chances of a trade deal with the US?
Well, I think, firstly, I broadly agree. I think there can be something done this year. I'd probably be a little bit more optimistic that you could get sort of something in line with a standard FTA in place, but it will be quite narrow and shallow relative to where people were hoping it would be, and it will be something that will have to be built on over time. So I think roughly in the same place. I think in terms of what the UK has to agree to, well, look, one of the flip sides of trying to do things very quickly is that you can't spend a lot of time negotiating on them. So you have to think of what your priorities are, and you may have to give in on areas you don't want to give in on. On the food standards one, I think, you know, it will be interesting to see how this pans out. I mean, look, from a purely practical perspective, you know, the US has FTAs with other countries that trade with the EU. The EU doesn't need to tie the UK into its standards to make sure that US stuff doesn't come into the EU. You know, there are rules of origin, there are checks at the borders. You know, anything that doesn't meet the EU standards won't be allowed into the EU, no matter what deal the UK has with it. So
essentially, we won't have frictionless trade with the EU anymore when it comes to chickens.
Exactly. And that's one of the upsides, or one of the changes from not going from frictionless trade as we were under Theresa May government, is that there are going to be checks at the border, there is going to be infrastructure, and anything the EU doesn't want to let in, be that chlorinated chicken, be it something that it thinks has been unfairly subsidised, the EU can stop, or it can put tariffs up, it can check it, it can do what it needs to. And so it has that ability, and so it is a very different proposition from what was being looked at before, and it's something that's managed quite commonly in international trade. And, you know, countries have trade agreements with other countries, and there are ways to make sure they don't bleed into each other.
The big question is, though, whether it can do it in Ireland or not, because of the the Northern Irish Protocol and you know, some talk from the British government that it wants to evade or at least elide some of the responsibilities that it supposedly signed up to in the withdrawal agreement.
Well, number 10 certainly is saying that it absolutely rules out any physical infrastructure whatsoever, new physical infrastructure being built. Do you think that's possible, Raoul?
I think if we're talking Great Britain to Northern Ireland, it's not possible. There will need to be infrastructure somewhere to manage what's in the protocol, because it will look quite a lot like a third country customs border. We don't know exactly the details, but it will look, look a lot like that. So there will need to be some infrastructure somewhere. There'll be a lot of admin processes to go along with it. If you're talking Northern Ireland into GB, I don't think you necessarily do need any infrastructure then. And I don't think, you know, it's a bit up to the UK exactly how far it wants to go. I think there will need to be some kind of exit declaration made as stuff leaves Northern Ireland to go into GB, but whether the UK wants to check that and how strictly it enforces it, I think is up to the UK. So it depends which direction you're looking, but I think in terms of going from GB to NI, yes, there will have to be some form of border. I think on this briefing, look, there is a lot of bluster going on. I think in reality, when you speak to people on the negotiation teams of both sides, they want to get in the room and see what can be done. I think the bigger issue is that the EU is taking a very absolutist approach to the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is you have to implement it and negotiate it as if there's nothing else going on in the future, as if we are in WTO world, and therefore it's a sort of the worst case implementation of this protocol. Whereas I think the UK's position will be, well, look, this needs to be something that can be practically implemented, that does meet the requirements of the withdrawal agreement, but also is politically sensitive and economically viable for both Northern Ireland and Ireland. And therefore, anything we can do to make it as light touch as possible is to the benefit of all communities in Northern Ireland and to the benefit of the UK and the EU, because it increases the chance that that protocol can actually be implemented in time and can actually be enforced and adhered to. And so I think that is quite a big difference in the starting position. And for all the noise around it about the briefing, I would ignore all of that. That is the key challenge in terms of the policy.
Both Tim and Raoul seem fairly optimistic about the idea of a trade deal. But if you listen to the language coming out of both Number 10 and Brussels, Marie, they seem absolutely miles apart. Do you think this is just saber-rattling?
I mean, I think the fact that the talks haven't started is probably a big part of it. You know, kind of like talking big before getting to sit down at the table is one part. But then what I'm finding quite interesting, actually, is that I do think there was a certain amount of sympathy from Brussels, not a tremendous amount, but a bit, was Theresa May, because there was the idea that, you know, she didn't have a majority, she had so many different factions trying to balance out, she didn't really want Brexit, she was a Remainer during the referendum, etc. Whereas now I do think that, you know, you can see Brussels faced with a government, you know, of Brexiteers, of people who campaigned for it, they're the people who wanted it, they're the people who are making it happen now. And it does feel to me there's a bit less patience, because it's like, well, actually, you know, you were the people who wanted this, what are the plans that our expectations are going to be higher? But also I think the fading influence of Angela Merkel in terms of like the EU side is going to be quite an interesting thing to keep an eye on, because she was the one who always tried to kind of see the situation, make sure, like, she did really want, you know, a decent deal to happen, but obviously she's on her way out. So I do think the EU may play harder ball, if that's a phrase, than it did in previous stages of negotiations. But again, you know, it is still very, very early stages.
And Tim, what about some of the other obstacles that we've got coming up in over the horizon in the trade talks? Fishing rights for one, ECJ oversight another. Are these insurmountable?
Well, I mean, ECJ oversight is, I think, for the UK insurmountable. I mean, the whole point of leaving was to escape, as it were, from the clutches of the European Court of Justice as far as Brexiteers are concerned. So there will have to be a way found for some other adjudicatory body to resolve disputes. And that is going to be a big one. I mean, I think on fisheries, that is a fascinating one. I mean, there is so much emotion invested rather than cash invested in that particular industry or on all sides. It is amazing how important it is. But of course, you know, to those coastal communities in France and in Spain, as in is in the UK, you know, it is their lifeblood for some of them. So it does seem strange to be arguing about an industry that in the UK anyway, I think accounts for less than, you know, 1% of what we do. But it's going to be a big argument. And it looks as if the EU is still determined to try and tie access to fisheries to other parts of the dossier.
And Raoul, what if there isn't a deal done by the end of the year? How potentially economically damaging could that be? Or is the difference between a Canada Plus and no deal at all, or as the government would like to style it, an Australia-style agreement, how big is the gap between those things and the potential economic consequences of them?
Well, I think the gap is much smaller than what we were looking at before. So if you look at the difference between the sort of Theresa May Chequers approach and no deal, there's quite a big difference in terms of the economic impact. I think if you're looking at the difference between a sort of Canada-style free trade agreement and no deal, actually, there's not a huge amount of difference. You know, whether or not you buy the economic models, but they give an indication of at least something to measure this by. You know, I think it's sort of, you're looking at a 6% sort of lower GDP growth over time from a Canada-style and probably close to 8% in a no-deal sort of scenario. So you're looking at 2% rather than, you know, a much bigger gap of 4 or 6%. And so actually a lot of the frictions, a lot of the impact has been taken. And I think the upshot of that is, you know, the price that, you know, I guess the UK government is willing to pay for that deal is probably lower. And therefore it will be potentially less willing to give on some areas, such as, you know, such as the level playing field, and was less willing to potentially align with EU rules. But I think on most of the areas, some of the ones you mentioned, there are landing zones that can be found. I think the biggest one is going to be probably state aid. I think that is both politically and technically quite difficult. It's politically fraught because the UK has said it wants to do something different already, and, you know, it ties into the heart of the new economic policy of levelling up and taking a different view on the economy and supporting businesses. But also it's technically quite difficult because, you know, it refers to fundamental treaty rights that are set out in the EU, and therefore it's not just a set of regulations, it's a set of concepts and principles as well, and therefore exactly how you translate that into a trade agreement and then into enforcement in the UK is quite practically and technically difficult. And so finding a middle way there is going to be the hardest. And the other things, you know, we have seen examples out there already. There's what's in existing trade agreements, but we shouldn't forget there's already what was put on the table in the original Northern Ireland backstop that Theresa May negotiated, where the EU set out what it was willing to accept in terms of level playing field in exchange for market access. So, you know, there are things out there that can already guide these negotiations.
And Marie, just hearing from Raoul, that it might be potentially politically tempting to go for a no-deal situation rather than a Canada trade deal if the price from Brussels is too high. Do you think there'll be any opposition left in the Conservative Party to that? I mean, we saw people willing to resign as cabinet ministers and, you know, losing their place in the Conservative Party over the issue of no deal. Has all opposition to that outcome melted away now?
Well, I do think that on the one hand, obviously during the general election of 2019, I think the Conservative Party made sure that every candidate signed up to the pledges of saying effectively, you know, I'm happy to do whatever it takes to get, you know, the right kind of Brexit. So obviously that's tied, I think, the hands of Conservative MPs to an extent. But on the other, what I would say, and, you know, unclear whether it'll happen or not, but actually if you do have a government with a big majority, I think that some MPs may feel that actually if they feel strongly enough about it, you know, they can show that they themselves care without making the government fall. So I think it's slightly, you know, the opposite, I guess, of what happened under May, which was that actually the price was quite high in terms of someone resigning, someone going against the whip, because it may mean, you know, a massive loss for the government. Whereas this, it's like, it's kind of virtue signalling effectively for Conservative MPs. So I could definitely see, you know, a few of them, and whether that would change anything, I'm not sure, because again, Boris Johnson has a huge majority, but obviously politically it would not look great if he can't carry his entire party with him.
And just one last question, Tim. How sort of exciting and explosive do you think these talks are going to be over the next year? Do you think it's going to be fairly dry and technocratic, or are we going to see lots of big bust-ups? And what do you think the end of next year looks like if we've managed
Well, I think the government must be torn, because in a way big bust-ups are quite good for the messaging, but on the other hand, actually I think they'd rather like to relegate some of this to a more kind of technocratic field where people don't feel that there's too much involved, and voters look elsewhere, in other words, at the government's wider agenda. I mean, I think coming back to the majority, it's interesting. I think there is obviously a link between the government's majority and what goes on in those trade talks, because, you know, on the one hand you could see a big majority is being an advantage to a government, because it can argue that it will be able to deliver what it promises EU negotiators. On the other hand, it can't do what I think Theresa May was able to do quite effectively sometimes and say, well, you know, look at what the situation is back home. I'm afraid I just can't do this. You'll have to give me some wiggle room. Boris Johnson, I think, isn't really going to be able to do that.
OK, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much, everybody. As we've said in our previous podcasts, we're thinking about how we should cover the upcoming US elections. Is this something you'd want to hear about? And would you want a whole episode on it? And who would you like to hear from? If you've got any ideas or feedback, please send an email to podcasts@theguardian.com. A huge thanks to Marie Leconte, Karen Robinson, Raoul Ruperel and Tim Bale for joining me on the show this week. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.